Welcome to the award-winning Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, covering metaphysics, ETs, shamanism, and channeling. Here you will find spiritual inspiration from today's thought leaders, along with cutting-edge insights from our interstellar brothers and sisters and ancient shamanic wisdom. Now, here's a new episode of Dare to Dream with your host, Debbie Dashinger.
Welcome to Dare to Dream, where the extraordinary isn't fiction. It's the conversation. What if your life isn't just happening to you, but is being played, leveled, and upgraded like a cosmic game? Today, Rizwan Rizverk joins us to reveal why simulation theory, the metaverse, and consciousness itself may hold the keys to navigating reality, accelerating awakening, and understanding what's coming next for humanity. He's a multifaceted technologist and thinker, an entrepreneur, video game industry pioneer, investor, indie film producer, best-selling author, futurist, and academic. Riz operates where MIT, Stanford, Cambridge, Silicon Valley, and the biggest questions about reality quietly converge. He's here to take us today inside the frontier, where technology meets consciousness, and to explore what simulation theory, AI, and virtual worlds reveal about who we are, where we're headed, and how reality itself may actually work. You can find out more about Riz at zenentrepreneur.com. And with that, I bring Riz on to the Dare to Dream show. It is so great to have you. Welcome, welcome.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. So I'm very excited to learn about all of this from you and what you know. So I want to build a little architecture. I like to do that, have a solid base before we really take off, and a foundation. And I'd like to start with asking you, how does a video game play? How does one play a video game? And how is that video game parallel to the simulation theory?
Well, so a video game is basically played, you know, on a computer screen or on your phone, and you basically have a character inside the game that represents you. Now, there are many different types of games, but for our purposes, perhaps the most interesting types of games are what are called MMORPGs, or massively multiplayer online role-playing games. And in that, every player is on their own computer, but their avatars are inside this virtual world together. So, you know, you might be an elf queen, I might be a dwarf, you know, warrior or wizard or something, and our avatars would be walking along and we would be interacting with each other. And there would also be other players, but there will also be NPCs, which stands for non-player characters. Those are the AIs within the game. So, you know, the bartender at the inn, or, you know, the goblins, or, you know, the guy who's selling you all of the, you know, the sword or the shield or the cloak, etc. So those are all characters that are controlled by the computer code or the AI. And so that's the basic model. Now, that your character inside a video game is usually referred to as an avatar. And that term comes from Sanskrit, and it's, you know, a spiritual term. It means when there's a divine entity, like a god or goddess, that comes down into a human incarnation. So you have an avatar of the divinity. And when the guys at Lucasfilm, which is George Lucas's company after he made Star Wars, they were building one of the first online role-playing games. They had this little character on the screen. They were using Commodore 64. So this is, you know, a long time ago, with dial-up lines. And they were looking for a term to describe your character on the screen. And they said it felt like they were taking themselves and squeezing themselves into the phone wire and ending up in this small character on the screen. And so they used the term avatar. And I think that's a neat coincidence because of the spiritual implications. Now, how does this relate to, you know, simulation theory more broadly? I mean, most people are familiar with the idea of simulation theory from the film The Matrix. And basically, in The Matrix, Neo, Keanu Reeves, thought he was living a real life. He was going to a real job. You know, he had a cubicle, he worked for a company, he was a hacker at night. And then he realized, through the guidance of Morpheus, and with the help of Trinity, that in fact the physical world was not real at all. It was a virtual simulation that was running, sort of a computer simulation, but it was actually running through a brain-computer interface. And so the simulation hypothesis is the idea that what we think of as physical reality is not really physical and it's not really real. It's almost a type of multiplayer game that we have decided to participate in, and that you and I, we are our avatar. So, my player is actually the larger part of me that is watching this game from outside. But because I have a virtual reality headset on, or a brain computer interface, or some other form of attachment, if you will, the spiritual traditions call it, going through the veil of forgetfulness as you incarnate. We have forgotten about that part of us, and we think this is the real world. So that's where, there's an intersection between spirituality, video games, and simulation theory as well.
Excellent, excellent. Totally makes sense. Okay, so we've got that part. So now what about the multiverse and its many world interpretations? How do we wrap our heads around the many worlds theory?
Well, so the many worlds theory is one of two popular interpretations of this problem in quantum mechanics, which is more formally called quantum indeterminacy, but we often call it the observer effect. And when I began to look at this, I was in Silicon Valley. I was a video game developer, and I was looking at virtual reality games, and I put on a VR headset. And as I started to play this game, my body forgot for a moment that I was inside a virtual table tennis game. And I tried to put the paddle down on the table and I tried to lean against the table. Of course, there was no table. The controller fell to the floor. I almost fell over. And so I began to wonder how long would it take us to build something as immersive as the Matrix? And that kind of got me down the rabbit hole. But then when I did that, I started to look at quantum mechanics and I realized that a lot of what quantum physics is telling us is that there is no physical world. And part of it is the observer effect. And in the observer effect, there's a set of probabilities of what might actually happen. And it's not until you observe a particular scenario that that probability wave collapses down. And so I looked at that and I thought, that reminds me a lot of how we build computer games. What happens with computer games is we have a lot of information, but we only need to render the part of the game that our character can actually see. And so, in the same way that right now, I'm not really talking to you right now, am I? I'm talking to my computer, and then my voice is being carried as bits, and you're talking to your computer. Just like I can't really tell if that's your living room or not, my computer doesn't have to render all of, say, Los Angeles or wherever you are. It only has to render the part, around you. And so that's how we build 3D video games. And so I began to think that quantum mechanics was a kind of optimization technique. Now, I know I haven't answered your question about the multiverse, but this leads to a second interpretation within quantum mechanics, which is that every one of those probabilities exists as a separate universe. Now, most people know about this because of fiction and popular media and the superhero movies. Lately there have been superhero movies where they will have multiple versions of Batman, and they'll have multiple versions of Spider-Man. There's like the old meme of the three Spider-Men, and Marvel explained it by saying, well, Andrew Garfield or the other, Tom Holland and the other, each of them are in a separate branch of the multiverse. So they could all kind of point to each other. And so in the multiverse, you are spinning off all of these different worlds every time a quantum decision is being made. Now, there's problems with both of these theories, because the first theory is the observer effect. It requires an observer, and science doesn't like that. And they don't know how the collapse happens. I mean, I explain it because the observer is the player of the game. In the multiverse theory, there's this problem that you're spinning off new physical universes all the time, and that's not so easy to do. I mean, we don't know of anything in nature that clones like an entire planet, let alone an entire universe. But information is very easy to clone. It's very easy to create copies. And so, as I began to think about the multiverse theory, I realized that a simulated multiverse actually makes sense because it means you can try out all of the different possibilities that might exist in your life, and then you can decide which one, you know, is going to be the main one. So you can preview. And so, you know, my books kind of go over these two different versions. The simulation hypothesis goes over the idea that space isn't real and that we're in a virtual world, and the simulated multiverse goes into this idea that you can actually spin off in a simulation. If you can run one, there's no reason you can't run more than one.
What indicates that? Is it thought? Is it choice that keeps creating multiple versions, multiple timelines, multiple ways of being and experiencing oneself and one's life? What's the
Well, you
inception right there that sparks the next creation?
well, I mean, that's not really well understood, but it has something to do with observation. And there are these different interpretations. And one interpretation is that there each of these possible futures are sending us back information. And it's the one that we resonate with the most that is the one that we end up going towards. But if the futures are sending us back information, that means that they have to have played out in some way already. So my idea is that we are running these simulations of the future to try to figure out which one might be the best one, the best. Now, best in quotes, because that doesn't mean the best in terms of, you know, it's the easiest one necessarily. In the same way, I often make the point because people tell me, well, I can't be in a video game because if I was, I would make myself a billionaire. I would make myself a famous actor or actress, and my life would be great and I would have no problems. And I say, well, that's not how interesting video games work. You have to have challenges, and you have to keep trying to conquer those challenges. Otherwise, the game gets boring really quickly. And the actors that win Academy Awards oftentimes are winning them for playing a character that has had a lot of suffering. That I think also applies to the world itself. You know, I also wrote a book about Swami Yogananda, who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi, and he used to say, you know, ceaseless joy is not the nature of this world. But he used to also use an analogy of the latest technology at the time when he was one of the first swamis to come from India and live in the US, and he set up shop, you know, eventually he came to Boston, but eventually he made his way across the country to LA. And I was asked to write a book about lessons, you know, from his autobiography. And one of the things that really stood out to me, well, first I said, why do you want me to write a book about Swami Yogananda? And they said, well, you know, I write about technology. And yeah, I quote him a lot, but they said, well, because we believe your ideas of viewing the world as a video game is a good way to explain many of these ancient spiritual concepts. And so when he came over, he used the latest technology of the time, which was films. And he would say that the world is like a film being projected on a screen, and we are the actors, and the actors are suffering, but the characters are suffering, but the actors don't necessarily die. We're interacting with each other, but it's all an illusion. And he would encourage, you know, his students to look away from the screen. And I believe if he were alive today, he would say it's like a film, but we're all, you know, actors, but we're also the audience. And we have scripts, but we have free will to change the scripts. And what does that sound like? It sounds like a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And so, you know, that's kind of how I view all of this. Not sure I answered your specific question there, but.
It's a beautiful answer. I loved this, and I love that you tied Yogananda into this. Listen, I've known about this concept for a really long time. Many people who channel extraterrestrials, something I'm into, talk about this because their concept, their ability to understand all of who we are and all of what's happening, they refer often to the multiverse, to multiple timelines and possibilities. And I appreciate the perspective you just put into it because we can buy into that, but it's also very hard to wrap our brains around. And I have also heard this idea of the screen. And of course, Shakespeare had the very famous line, you know, all the world's a stage and we're all actors, we're all merely players, is basically what he was saying. So it's the same concept, the same wisdom that has come down the pike through history. The other thing you talk about is about the Mandela effect. And for people who don't know what that is, this is a phenomenon. Generally, there are large groups of people who share really real, vivid, but false memories of events, facts, details that never happened. And it started because they remembered that Nelson Mandela had died in prison, which he didn't. Or there's the Berenstain Bears being spelled Enstein or Berenstain. And I actually had a situation like this, but I'd love you to talk about the Mandela effect and if this is like a glitch in reality, is it a synchronicity? Is it a deja vu? Is it another universe that we're experiencing?
Yeah, and so I began to get deep into this idea of multiple timelines and the Mandela effect, partly because of the science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. And he wrote the books that were behind the movies Blade Runner, Minority Report, Total Recall, many others. And I interviewed his wife, Tessa Dick, who's still alive. She's older now, obviously. And Philip passed away in 1982, I think, just before Blade Runner came out, a few months before. But he gave a speech in Metz, France, where he said, "We are living in a computer programmed reality, and the only clue we have to it is when some variable is changed, some alteration occurs in our reality." And so Tessa encouraged me to read the rest of that speech or watch it. And it's available online if anyone wants to go and find it. And so I looked at the rest of what he said. And after that, he said, "We would have the sense of deja vu. We would have the sense of reliving some of the same events or replaying some of the same things." And such a feeling is a clue that in the past, some variable was changed and the simulation was run forward again. And when it ran forward, we still have memories of the previous run. And so that got me down this idea of looking at what would be the implications if we could go back and change variables and rerun timelines, which led me to the simulated multiverse. And that is a good way to explain the Mandela effect. Now, many people just take that as the mainstream explanation, which is, oh, it's just a faulty memory. But then again, you have people who are very close to a subject who remember it differently. And so the blogger who coined the term Mandela effect, after the Nelson Mandela example you gave, she actually was at a Comic-Con like conference. I think it was in Atlanta, Dragon Con, in a Star Trek panel with the original actors from, the 1960s Star Trek actors. This was like later. And if you know your Trekkies or Trekkers, whatever you want to call them, they know their episodes quite well, right? Saturday Night Live even spoofed that back in the day. But the people in the audience were saying, "Do you remember this episode where, you did this and Captain Kirk did that?" And the guys on the panel were like, "We never recorded such an episode. What are you talking about?" And people in the audience, or some subset of people in the audience, were like, "Yeah, I love that episode. I watched it so many times." And so that, got her to think. But if you think of Trekkies in this case, they are closer to that in some way. And so there might be some validity. And so the way that I came to think about it is that if you actually change a variable and you run it again, like when you run a simulation, you never run it just once. You run it more than once. Why? Because you want to see what's likely to happen. And then you want to see what is the most favorable outcome, whether it's a virus spreading or the stock market or a war simulation or whatever kind of simulation you want to run. So you would the weather, you would change variables and rerun it again. And so this became a way to think about this. And so, in fact, Philip K. Dick said he actually wrote a book called The Man in the High Castle, which became an Amazon series. And in that series, you have an alternate timeline where Germany and Japan won World War II. And the book was written, and I think it takes place in around 1960. So, World War II was pretty recent memory at the time. But he said he wrote this book based on residual memories of an actual alternate timeline where the Axis powers won World War II and it was a police state that they imposed, within the US. Some people might think we're heading back into that, but that's a, I try to stay away from politics. But He later he said he got the full memories of that. And so in this model, it means that timeline might have run to a certain point, but then it was rewound and rerun. And so people who have memories of that, he said we would have to find a group of people that remembered an alternate past and present. Now, this was back in 1977, and it wasn't until the internet became a thing and was really widely used that, and social media that people were able to share these experiences. And it's amazing how many of these experiences were out there. I mean, do you remember the Tiananmen Square tank incident? I was just in college at the time. And do you remember if the guy who was in front of the tank, whether the tank ran him over or not? It was like
Did not. No,
he did
and I
not run him
remember the
over.
did not run him over, and I remember the photos because that was a very popular photo in the newspapers at the time to see this man stationary, and to me the tank looked stationary facing him with its firing.
And then it would try to go around him, and then he would go in front of it, and it would stop again. And that's what I remember as well. Now, there is a subset of people who remember the tank running over the guy, and they say it was the bloodiest thing they ever saw. Excuse me, it was the bloodiest thing they had ever seen on television at that point in time. And so I'll do these unofficial surveys, and within, like, I was on a panel with our mutual friend Paul Hynek, I think last year at a conference, and I asked that there were like five or six panel members, and two of them remembered, the tank running over the guy. It was about 20, less, more than 20% in that case, but usually it's about 20%. And so I began to look for these cases where people were closer to it. Like, do you remember the thinker, the statue of the thinker?
Yes, of
And do you
course.
remember where the guy's hand was, like, when he was thinking? Any guess?
I mean,
This
I would have guessed the right, but I'd have to
is,
look
okay.
at it
Okay,
again.
well, most people would say it's like this. And if you go look today, like at Stanford in the Bay Area, probably somewhere in LA too, they have a bronze cast of it. And I went and looked at it, and it's kind of like this. And but he doesn't have a strong fist; he just has his hand under his chin. But then there are all these groups of people taking pictures like this, saying, "I'm in the pose of the thinker." And of
Wow.
course, we could write it off. But then I looked in the historical account, and I found a picture from the 1910, let's say, I forget exactly what year, but it was around then, unveiling in London of the first, bronze cast of the thinker. And this guy took a picture of G.B. Shaw, George Bernard Shaw. And he basically took it there, and he says, "Here is G.B. Shaw in the pose of the thinker." And, he's got his hand on his forehead, not under his chin. And so you begin to wonder, are these just bad memory, or are we actually remembering another timeline? And in a simulated universe, that would make sense. Now, there's one, I'll give you one last example about this idea of the simulated universe and multiple timelines and how it might relate. Philip's wife, Tessa, told me that he communicated with some entities. And I looked back at my interview, and she said they kind of looked to her just like a blob, but from his perspective, he actually saw like something, somebody he was communicating with, who he claimed were manipulating these variables in reality. And he says that they said they prevented the assassination of JFK in Dallas, which is, as far as we know, that's where JFK was assassinated, right? But then in that other timeline, he ended up getting assassinated in Orlando or in another city. And so each time they ran the events, or it ended up in a worse situation somehow. We ended up in like a nuclear war. And so, are these Mandela effects the memories of different timelines? Actually, I'll give you one last story before we. So perhaps the most important to me, one of the most important Mandela effects is scriptural changes. Because people take their scripture seriously. Again, it's not going to be a casual memory. And there's a line in Isaiah about the lion and the lamb. But if you go and you look at, people are telling you they look at their King James Bible, and that line is not there. It's about the wolf and the lamb. It's not about the lion and the lamb. And yet, people have like these, clocks and things on the wall and have a picture of a lion and a lamb. So you have artifacts. So I began to wonder, are there other religious scriptures that have changed? And so I looked at the Quran, which is memorized word for word. And I grew up in a Muslim household, and I was like, why do we need to memorize it? I mean, you just read it. I mean, it's obviously a book, it's there. And so I looked around to see if anybody had claimed anything had changed. And there was a Sufi imam, and he said that one of the reasons why it's still memorized to this day and why they originally memorized it, word for word, is because there are entities that are allowed to change physical object, but they are not allowed to change your memory, and those entities are called the jinn. I thought that was a really interesting, story or anecdote around, my explorations of the Mandela effect and multiple timelines.
Was amazing. That was amazing. And I'm going to get to these jinn in a minute because I have things to say about that. I've known about this Mandela effect. I would imagine most people do, but I had my own experience, although it was not a large group, it was a personal experience that is unprecedented. No one can explain it. I had a very, very routine blood work done, lab work. And I was just looking online to grab the blood work. I keep it in a folder. And I was looking down, yes, all the things, perfect, perfect. I know I'm in really good health. And all of a sudden, there's a page with the strangest report. And it says Candida albicans, and it's in red. And it is indicating that I have this huge overgrowth of yeast in my body, that I am aware of what this means. I know about health. And I know that is really not a good thing to have because I know that means enormous changes in what you eat and drink. And I'm thinking, I could not eat or drink more healthy. How is it possible that it's indicating this? But it's very alarming. Nobody's contacting me. So I go ahead and I call the doctor's office and I said, wow, we need to have a talk about this. And she says, absolutely, he's going to get back to you. We're going to look at this and someone will call you. And then they call me back and they say, we don't see it. And I say, what do you mean you don't see it? It's like, I even read the numbers that it's at, the percentage it's supposed to be in, what's normal, what's not. And then I was thinking, why are you even testing me for this? This is not even an issue that I came to you for. Well, I was so blown away when she said they didn't find it. I ended up calling Quest Laboratories. And I said, please, there is some very bizarre anomaly going on, but it is my health. And I would be grateful if you can look into this and give us some indication what's happening. And here is this lovely person working with me on the phone and coming back to the phone after he does some deep checking and saying, I am so sorry, Miss Dashinger. There is nothing on your blood work about having Candida albicans. Now, I'm not smoking anything, drinking anything. I'm about as sober as can be and shocked. And I am also grateful because I thought this is what it's like to have that happen, to see something that is so real, absolutely happen before your eyes, in your experience, and then it's wiped away. It's gone. Nobody can speak to it. But you.
Well, that's amazing. It's a kind of a personal Mandela effect. And I feel like we may all be experimenting. So there's the timelines at the big level, where we're talking about the civilizational level. And you might say, whoever the simulators are trying to get to a certain point and they're trying to see what will happen. But then individually, we may be doing this as well, where each of us is trying out different aspects of our lives. And if that were true, perhaps it would have led you down a different path. And perhaps that was not the path that, for whatever reason, your player decided, you should be going down. And yet you still remembered it because you actually experienced it. I find that really, really fascinating.
Too. I love the fact that you bring up the jinn. So I'm really aware of the jinn because my partner is an author. He writes books and he's did enormous research, fascinating research into the jinn, and they're part of his books. So for folks who don't know, these are entities very much believed, by the way, believed in certain parts of the world, entities who can change things. So, Islamic, Middle Eastern, pre-Islamic traditions, these jinn are described as beings made of smokeless fire. But they exist in parallel and unseen realms, and they have free will. and they can manifest, they can shape, shift, and they can whisper. So the jinns aren't God, they don't create reality, they interact with it differently. I'm wondering, Riz, should we think of jinn as an ancient model for something modern language is only now circling around again?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the jinn in particular, with the Middle East and South Asia, like in Pakistan and India, those are one type of entity that is often talked about. And then most people in the West have heard of the term genie because of Aladdin. And genie means, a singular male jinn. There's actually a term for a singular female jinn. But these stories have been documented in different parts of the world with different names, whether it's the Fae in the Celtic traditions and Jacques Vallée, who has been working on the UFO phenomenon forever. In his book Passport to Magonia, talks about some of the French and European traditions of this alternate parallel set of beings who could come into our reality and who can go out of our reality. And I feel like today some of our discussions around aliens or abductions could be related to these types of entities. And what's interesting is Whitley Strieber, who wrote Communion, and I don't know if he's going to be at Conscious Life Expo this year, but I know he was previous years. But he told me a story of a young man who had a relationship with this young woman, and she got pregnant, and she called him over to her house one day, and she said, "I have to tell you something." He thought, "Okay, we're going to get married. This is going to be great." And she goes, "Well, I'm not really human. I'm actually a gray alien." And supposedly she changes her form. What I like to call her avatar changed. Like, and then it changed back. And she said, "And I'm taking the baby." I mean, there wasn't a baby yet, but I'm taking the baby into the world of the gray aliens, and you won't see either of us again. Now, some mainstream people would say, "Well, that's just a bad breakup, right?" But the reality is, when I was looking at the stories of the jinn from Middle Eastern scholars who've documented these, I found there were almost exactly similar stories where a man would marry a jinn woman, they would have kids, and then one day she would say, "I'm going back into the jinn world, and you'll never see me again," or the kids, and she took them and she disappeared, and no one could find her. And so it's interesting to me that we are going through a process, perhaps, of interpretation when we talk about some of these entities that people see today. And it's possible that whether it's angels, demons, jinn, fae, aliens, that these are entities presenting themselves to us in a way that we might understand and we might be able to make sense of it, just like in the 1950s. Now, part of my academic work is on science fiction and how it influences society. And science fiction has had, I think, an influence on how we think about these other entities that people are experiencing because we present them as aliens. And in the 1950s, some of the contactees, the aliens, quote unquote, would tell them they're from Venus or Mars. Okay, now we know they're probably not from Venus or Mars, but perhaps that also doesn't mean they were lying. Maybe that's exactly what they told them because that was something that was very well understood. People were worried about aliens from Mars. Just like today, we're being told they're aliens from Zeta Reticuli or from another solar system because our science, the knowledge of science, has expanded to where we now know there are planets in other solar systems. Therefore, it's an in paradigm, even though most scientists hate to talk about UFOs and alien abductions. Like, UFOs is one thing, alien abductions is a whole other thing when you get into academia and start talking about stuff. But how much of it is being shaped, our interpretation is being shaped by the popular media and by our understanding of science and science fiction up to today. In fact, Jacques Vallée, he was the inspiration for the French scientist in Close Encounters, and he said he didn't meet Steven Spielberg until well into the filming, and his one problem with the movie was that they were presented only as aliens. Like Spielberg got rid of any other types of, and by that point, Jacques had concluded they may or may not be aliens at that point, but they're still real.
That's fascinating. That is really interesting information. And I was it for you? I'm wondering if it was for you or for Danny Goler. I can't remember which because I saw a little clip. It was really focused on either you or Danny, and there was a whole interview going on, and they actually had a small clip of Jacques Vallée. speaking about one of you, both of you, Mandela effect, who knows? But yes, saying, I love this work because of the simulation theory, his deep belief in it, and ability to follow it and validity about it. Was that about
Yeah,
you?
it could have been because Jacques and I have talked a lot about simulation theory, and he has talked about my work. In fact, your audience might appreciate it. There's a little synchronicity that happened when I first published the first edition of the Simulation Hypothesis was in 2019, which was the 20th anniversary of The Matrix, and I just published a second edition last year, and that's the one that's out now because AI has come a long way. And so I published it on March 31st, which was the 20th anniversary of The Matrix. And so Jacques actually was at Esalen, and he gave a talk, and he ended his talk with a picture of me and my book and talking about simulation theory. And then they ended the talk, and they all left to go to the cafeteria. And who was in the cafeteria but Morpheus? Lawrence Fishburne was literally sitting there after he had been talking about The Matrix. And so I was told this story by three different people. I wasn't there at that particular time, but I
Wow,
think
what an
that.
honor. That's so cool. It's funny how it all sort of coalesced. It all came together and it makes sense. Those particular characters or avatars would be there at the same time and you got honored. I love that. Well, we're going to take a quick pause, my friends. We're going to go a little deeper into this work. I have something special for you. For those of you who would like to learn your galactic origins, which stars you're from, past lives you've had out in the galaxy, you can go to debbiedashinger.com/starseed. It's a free report and video, very comprehensive. And you'll start to identify some of the features that you definitely exhibit in this life and why that makes sense. And all the links are in the show notes. Also, you can join Riz and myself at the Los Angeles Conscious Life Expo. That is February 20th through the 23rd. It's held every year. This is the 24th annual, and it is the most phenomenal event. Don't miss it. Riz will be on panels. Riz is speaking. He's going to share a little bit more about that later. And that's February 20th through the 23rd. You can go to debbiedashinger.com/CLE. And if you would like to have the adventure of a lifetime, March 2026, you are invited to join me on a cruise to Greece and Turkey. It's a mystery school at sea cruise. I'm speaking on it, I'm performing on it. Laura Eisenhower will be there, Debbie Solaris, Geraldine Orozco, Neil Garr, myself, and way more. Join us at mysteryschoolatsea.com. Please use my name for the reference. And if this conversation we are having here today and sharing with you means something, like the video, subscribe, comment. I do read the comments. You're supporting us by subscribing, by liking, and by following all of this. And of course, we get to meet and influence more people who are really hungry about this information around the globe when you do that. Thank you in advance for your support. Okay, back with Riz. And I'm so curious to ask you. This knowledge that you have, and it really makes sense when you talk about it. It's a bit mind-blowing, but I love it and it makes total sense. Do you personally use this to influence your life? So, if you have the ability somewhere to go out and view different ways of how things might turn out, should you do this, choose that, etc. Do you use it somehow and harness that in order to better influence your next steps, your choices, and who you are today?
Well, yeah, I think it has changed my perspective on my own life. And I think there's two ways, generally, there's more than two, but there's two ways, that I think this has influenced my life. The first is that I have drawn a connection between simulation theory and what near-death experiencers have described as the life review, where they have to go back and review every single thing that's happened in their lives. But they do it in what's called a holographic panoramic life review. So they actually have to play the part of the other people in their life. And they have to experience how that person felt. More than that, they might even experience the ripple effects of their actions in that person's life. And I learned about this from Danyon Brinkley, who I think is going to be a Conscious Life Expo. He usually
He's
is.
been on the show, yeah.
Yeah. So, and he used to be in the military and he literally shot people. And in his, one of his or many of his near-death experiences, he had to review what it was like to be shot by him. And then he had to
Wow.
see the ripple effect on the lives of that person's family.
Wow.
And so for me, that reminded me very much of how we build video games. And I was involved in a startup where you could put on a VR headset and you could replay a game that was not virtual reality to begin with. It was on a screen. And you could basically, if you were in a first person shooter, you could go to any location and you could see yourself, your character shooting the other character, and you could be in that person's shoes. Now, of course, we don't know how to do feelings within the life review, but to me, as a scientist and engineer, I said, well, how would this work? To do that, you have to record everything that's happening and then you can replay it back. And Danyon was, very, very nice to give me a nice blurb on to talk about this virtual reality that we live in. And it was the life review for me that drew that connection. And so if you think of the most popular content on YouTube, it's actually video games. It's people watching a replay of a video game session. And it's the same kind of thing as recording a life and then rewatching it later. And so for me, the first way that this impacts me in my life is I began to think, well, if this is a video game, then I'm going to have to see how the game is evaluated afterwards and everything. Just like, if you play a game of football, the coach might project onto the screen and say, hey, how did we do? Oh, well, that we didn't do so well. This one we did so well. And the near-death experiences tell us that we're the only judge, really, ourselves, but how we treat other people. So that's the first thing, I think, way that this influences me. The other way that's, I think, more related directly to your question of these multiple timelines is when something bad happens to us, right? And bad things happen to us often, right? I mean, everybody has issues, whether it's relationship issues, financial issues, stress, career, or physical health. We can view those as just bad things that have happened to us, or we can view them as a kind of more difficult quest that our player has decided for whatever reason to go down this path. And sometimes it may be because they've seen what would happen if we didn't go down that path. They, meaning us, because it's really us playing ourselves. And so in my own case, I wrote this book after I had a major health crisis. So, I was in Silicon Valley. I was an entrepreneur. I was teaching a startup program at MIT. I was kind of at the height of my entrepreneurial career. And just 2 weeks before I was supposed to present this program, I had a borderline heart attack and I ended up having to have heart surgery. And during that time, while I was recovering, I mean, it wasn't sort of a traditional NDE, but while I was recovering, I had a series of visions. And in these visions, it became clear to me that I was being told, well, don't you remember you had a life plan? The plan was first to be an entrepreneur and then to be a writer. Well, you're still in this business of Silicon Valley and still in the business of trying to make money. Like, you should be done with that by now. You're 48 years old. You should have started on this other path by now. And what happened was after the heart surgery, so not only did I have the insight, but every time I tried to jump back, because my conscious mind tried to jump back into a business or Silicon Valley, I would end up back in the hospital. But I had just enough energy to take an Uber to Starbucks and write a couple hours a day. And in 9 months, I wrote two books, one of which was a book about startups for Columbia Business School Press, which kind of wrapped up my startup career. It was a way for me to say, okay, I'm done with that. Here's everything I learned. And I wrote The Simulation Hypothesis, which went on to become a bestseller. But also it pulled in the different threads of my life until that time. And so if we view life perhaps as a series of challenges, it makes these things one, easier to deal with. Two, it gives us perspective. But three, it may be that we are already putting ourselves on a different path. And so when we're trying to manifest or visualize, I usually tell people it's not so much about creating the future as tapping into which of those timelines would be best. And if you can somehow tap into that. You can influence yourself to go that way. Or if you're really hard-headed like me, the universe slams you and makes you go into a certain direction. Exactly.
Wow. And you know what's amazing about that too? Yes, you know, the body has so much wisdom, the universe, but the fact that you listened, you know, you got the memo. It's like, okay, the surgery was enough. Not everybody does. Not everybody then takes appropriate action on their own behalf. So kudos to you for finding a way to take that Uber to the Starbucks and writing and getting those books done. And like, I'm on it. I'm on it.
Right.
I'm
And I
doing
often say that now. It's like, I'm on it. Don't worry. There's a few more books I've got to work on. I'm working on it.
That's
Yeah.
amazing. That's really amazing. Because writing a book, I know, is no easy small task. It's quite a commitment to complete and all the steps there, and even when you're done. Well, where does AI fit into this, Riz? This rise of AI, which is the trajectory, is just amazing right now. And these virtual worlds, which mirror humanity's possible origins inside of a simulated universe. How do these different pieces come to play?
But well, I'm glad you asked that because I mentioned the story about when I was playing a virtual reality ping pong game, and what really got me down this rabbit hole was to figure out how long would it take us as a technological civilization to actually go and build something like the Matrix, which would be a physical world or a virtual world that was indistinguishable from a physical world and with AI characters inside that world that where we would not be able to distinguish whether those characters are run by a human being or whether they're AI characters. And I call that the simulation point, which is a kind of technological singularity. Now, when we hear the term singularity, we mostly think of AI, superhuman AI taking over the world, a la Skynet and the Terminator, for example. There's lots of other good science fiction on that subject as well. But the guy who really used that term in its current context of a technological singularity was a guy named Werner Vinge. He was a science fiction author, but he also was a professor of computer science. And he said there are multiple ways we might reach a technological singularity. And what he said is at some point, what happens is that the technology grows exponentially such that life will be different for humans. And superintelligent AI was one way, connecting humans with computers was another way. Networking different sets of computers, and there might be many different ways. And I like to say that if we're able to get to the simulation point, we're able to plug into these virtual worlds. That's another way. Now, just today, so as I said earlier, part of the reason I wrote this, Penguin Random House asked me to write the second edition of the simulation hypothesis was because ChatGPT hadn't even been released, so I was projecting forward. In 2019, this is what I think will happen with AI. But now, of course, now so much has happened, and just today, Google released what they call Genie 3. So this is their interactive AI world generation engine. And so what you can do is you can type in a prompt and it will generate not just a video, but it can generate an entire virtual world, and you can like navigate around this world. And these videos are fairly amazing, and you see these worlds with mountains, and you can modify the world, and you can tell it, you can give it a prompt and say, okay, now change, the mountains to this other thing. And so, this idea of AI is a way to maintain the virtual world because people might say, well, there's no way we could build, anybody could build a virtual world that is as realistic as our physical world. Well, what we do in computer science is we use optimization techniques and we use AI. I mean, there was a game called No Man's Sky. It came out a while ago, actually, even before the current AI trend. They were using code to do these things. And they had 18 quintillion planets. And there's no way any video game designers on Earth could design that many planets. They used AI and procedural generation to create them for you. So it always looked like there was more. And then the other side of AI that's important is the AI characters. Can AI characters be conscious or not? Are we in fact a kind of AI? And that gets back to what I talked about earlier, which is the RPG versus the NPC version of the simulation hypothesis. In the NPC version, We're all just AI characters inside the game, and some folks outside are watching us. That scares people, particularly in the spiritual world, right? Because who wants to be just soulless AI? But in a video game, you have both avatars, player characters, and you have NPCs, non-player characters, as a mix. And there's something in between the two, which is that if our minds are like a neural net, they're trained on what we've learned during this run of the simulation. But there's another part of us that's still the player outside that may be issuing these prompts. And I have a feel, I have a new phrase that I like, which I call NPC mode, because one person once said to me, I think my husband is an NPC. That's not a good way to think about. Because, well, it seems like he's being put in my life for this particular purpose or doing this particular thing. And so, if we think of people as playing roles, that's okay. But I think we all enter NPC mode where we're just playing a role for somebody else, or we're just repeating what we've been trained on in this life, rather than connecting back to our purpose or to our player.
Incredible. Actually, a really great way to look at things. It's a really, in a way, a nice way to detach from the reality of somebody being in your life and whatever, they may make you feel at times, but instead to look at them as though, oh, they have a purpose for something. It makes it, I think, easier with some people in our lives.
Particularly when we have challenges, right? With those
Exactly.
people.
Not as taxing. And so with all of this, then could death be less of an ending and more of an exit point or a respawn? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case. I mean, since I wrote this book, I've gone deeper into the spiritual traditions and how they talk about incarnating. And, I was asked to speak at an Islamic jurisprudence conference. And I said, well, why are you asking me to talk at an Islamic jurisprudence conference? There was an Ayatollah there. There were like Cairo scholars from Cairo. They said, no, we want you to talk about the simulation hypothesis. And they were debating abortion and, when is it okay to have an abortion? Is it the day after? Is it 40 days? Is it 120 days? Can you do it all the way up to birth? Basically, they were asking, when does incarnation occur into the body? And I said, well, I have a different definition of that. Incarnation is when you put on the virtual reality hell headset or you plug in and the forgetfulness sets in. And it turns out this idea of forgetfulness has been given to us in all the spiritual traditions. And going back to the Greeks who talk about crossing Lethe, the river of forgetfulness, or the Chinese traditions where they have Meng Po, who's the goddess of forgetfulness, and she brews the tea of forgetfulness. And in the Islamic tradition, Sufi traditions, there's 70,000 veils between you and God, and they're called the veils of forgetfulness. And a person is called insan, which kind of means prisoner in a way, but prisoner of nisyan. Nisyan means forgetfulness. So we're all prisoners of forgetfulness. And then basically, when you come out of it, you are then basically taking off the virtual reality helmet. And now you can look back at your life. And I think that's what happens when people have a near-death experience. They disconnect a bit and they're back in that world. And then either they're given a choice or they do actually, come back. Some people may decide to respawn. They may try to go into another life with a different character. Sometimes I found the exact same metaphors being used. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, it says that the soul, the Atman in the Eastern traditions, puts on the body like a set of garments, and then it takes off those. And that is a technological metaphor. I mean, they're not trying to say that they literally are putting on clothes. And Rumi, the great Sufi poet, also said, the soul puts on the body like a set of garments. So they're using technology as a way to explain something. And I think if we think of the video game metaphor as the latest technology, we could also describe the process of incarnation. Now, the simulation hypothesis is a couple of assertions. One is that the world is information, it's not physical. Two, that information is being computed. Three, that information is rendered and presented to us to look as if it's physical, even though it's not really. The fourth is that it's all a big giant hoax. And the fifth is that we decided to participate in this hoax.
Wow.
And do you know the film critic Roger Ebert? Remember him?
Yes.
And he died a few years ago, and his wife
Right.
was quoted in an article, and she said the last thing he said to her just before he died was, "Oh my God, this is all a hoax." And she said he literally meant it, like this physical world is a hoax, because they had talked about that beforehand. And I believe that's, similarly to this idea of video game, you are coming out of your affiliation or association or forgetfulness into the video game character. And now you can look back at it and you can decide what you want to do differently in the future if you were to play the game again.
Amazing. Thank you. I've had so many chills while you were speaking today. This is so articulate, so brilliant to connect with you like this. And I can't help also but think about the Avatar movies every time you speak about plugging in. And the one thing, and I do actually have a criticism of the movie, although the concept is so beautiful, so beautiful. So enjoyable. I think these are ways and waves of waking up people in the public to another idea, way of reality being. There's so much violence in them. It always, the movies inherently come back to the war with the beautiful blue people and usually, stupid humanity. Like, and I would like so much more just to spend time with these beautiful avatars in their world and experience that. I'd like to plug into that, right? So my 5 cents there. For people who are listening to us, who are watching us, Riz, is there one practical action after this conversation that they can engage with reality more consciously? Like you beautifully laid out those 5 steps and the ending with it's all a hoax. Knowing all of this, and it does actually make sense the way you present it. What might somebody do to better engage with their own life and maybe better redirect their own being while in this life?
It's a good question. I mean, I would suggest, first of all, as things happen to you, I would reflect on, okay, if this were a game, and if I were to accept, so the way video games work these days is you have these quests and you accept the quests, and then sometimes the quests are done with other people, right? So you have a two-person quest or a multiplayer quest, and sometimes they're just individual. Now, in video games, there are things like, oh, go raid the Goblin King, or go to the Forest of Dragons or whatever. But in this video game, their quests could be, relationships with people or challenges to people that we need to either overcome or we need to learn something from. And so if we view the world as a video game, first and foremost, we can say, well, what kind of a quest would this be if this were to be put in front of me, or if I were to have accepted it? And then the second is, I think as we look forward, we ask ourselves, what are the things that we're naturally drawn to? And those could be part of our storyline. So the way that I like to present it is, when you have a Dungeons and Dragons character, like, I used to play the game with when I was a kid, with sitting at a table, and you'd have a character, and you would have chosen, you have to choose your character. You choose like an elf, and you're a dwarf or a human, and you choose the profession. What are they going to do? And then you choose the storyline, and then there's a campaign that you're going on. Is to say, well, what storyline might I have chosen for myself, and what aspects of that storyline are still unfulfilled? And then you can start to maneuver yourself by trying to visualize that into that particular, because we still have that particular timeline, because we still have free will. Just because we said we were going to do X doesn't mean we have to do X. That's the problem with forgetfulness. But we get clues all the time through synchronicity, through hunches, about things that we might want to do. And some of those things are just lessons we have to learn. And so I think by thinking about our storyline, we can do that. Now, more practically, you can even do a visualization and a meditation, where you try to step back and see yourself and this whole world on a screen, in a virtual reality screen. This used to happen to me spontaneously when I was on planes, and I'd be dozing off, and I would literally see like a whole three-dimensional world and a plane with me in it, as if there was a part of me outside watching, like not just, me specifically, but watching the whole thing and zooming in. And if you learn to develop that kind of meditation or detachment, you can then, when you come back in, I think you can live a more conscious life while you're here.
Beautiful. Well, what's next, Riz? How can people find you? Sounds like you're always working on the next book, the next book. Tell us about Conscious Life Expo, what you're speaking about there and when, and just also in general, how can people find out more about you or the events? My God, you are the busiest guy. You are speaking constantly everywhere. It's so impressive. And you've also done this beautiful slate of interviews with some very, very well-known folks. So it's such an honor to have you here. Tell us about all the ways we can find you.
Sure. So my website is zenentrepreneur.com, which was based off the title of my very first book I wrote, which was called Zen Entrepreneurship years ago. People can reach me on social media on Instagram at Riz Cambridge, like the city or the university, or on Twitter X at Riz Stanford, like the university. And then I'll be at Conscious Life Expo giving a talk on glitches in the matrix. And so we'll be talking about some of the things that we talked about today, including, how does simulation theory help explain things like out-of-body experiences, remote viewing, ghosts, synchronicity, deja vu as clues. And also we'll be doing a parallel life exercise, perhaps, where we can tune into one of our alternate timelines and see if there's something we might be able to bring back.
That's exciting. Okay. Well, this is Dare to Dream. Riz, what do you next dare to dream? What are your future dreams and goals?
Well, so part of it is, I just went back to academia a few years ago, and I just finished a PhD. Literally, graduated in December. It's January now, and so it was interesting for me later in life, having become a full-time writer and then jumping back in academia. So I'm looking at ways to bridge the worlds of industry, academia, and spirituality. And I right now I'm doing that through my books. Because you can go in and talk to a physicist about the simulation hypothesis. If you start go in and start talking to physicists about ghosts or near-death experiences, they kind of tune out. So part of my mission is to try to bring these worlds closer together. So I'm writing a book about going deeper into the ideas I talked about today with respect to traditional religions and the mystical traditions, and how the simulation hypothesis can actually be a way to connect what all of these different sacred texts have been saying. They've just been using terminology that would make sense to people thousands of years ago. And we can rephrase that, and that gives us a way to connect not just between religion and science, but between people from different religions. But so that's a book that I'm working on, along with some other stuff that I'm working on, a sequel to my first book. Zen Entrepreneurship should be coming out this year as well.
Brilliant. Congratulations on all of that. I can't wait to see you in a few weeks, February 20th through the 23rd, Conscious Life Expo. That really sounds like a great presentation. I'm going to make it to that room for sure. And folks, I end today's show with this quote: across cultures, across centuries, we've described the same mystery with different names. Djinn, glitches, simulations, Mandela effects. The language changes, but the signal remains. So reality is layered, consciousness endures, and the universe is far more alive and I think mysterious than we were taught. This has been Dare to Dream for curious souls who are connecting with extraterrestrial life, higher dimensions, and shamanism. In the next weeks on the podcast, I am featuring interviews with the amazing Wendy Kennedy, Billy Carson, and Daryl Anka. Remember to support us by liking, by subscribing. Thank you so much for joining us today on Dare to Dream.
Thanks for joining us this week on Dare to Dream. Make sure to visit our website, debbiedashinger.com. That's DEBBI. DACHINGER. You can subscribe to the show on YouTube and all major podcast sites, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this program, we'd appreciate a like and comment, or tell a friend about the podcast. That will help us out as well. And if you like this conversation, you might want to check out Debbie's shamanic healing programs. And Debbie is available for coaching to write your book, and her company takes your finished book to guaranteed international bestseller. Be sure to subscribe for our next episode of Dare to Dream podcast with Debbie Dashinger, your number one transformation conversation.